it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, tax reform bills move forward in the House and Senate. Also, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle testify about widespread sexual harassment in Congress, even involving sitting members. Former Senator Barbara Boxer of California talks with me about her own experience with harassment on the Hill.
I had to go to the chairman, and I said, "Mr. Chairman, what happened was horrible." He said, "We thought we were complimenting you."
And more women in Alabama come forward alleging that Senate candidate Roy Moore sexually assaulted or propositioned them as teenagers.
I think that he hopes that he could just issue blanket denials and that people will stick with him.
Then,
if you're smart enough and you've been there long enough, there's a certain equality that you earn as you get your wrinkles. I've earned that equality.
HBO executive Sheila Nevins, on working her way up in the film business, aging gracefully, and her own experience with sexual harassment in Hollywood. First, Barbara Boxer. She's former U.S. Senator from California, now the founder of the political action committee PAC for a Change, and author of The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. Senator Boxer, it's so good to talk with you again.
Same here, Diane.
You know, just this morning, this news about Al Franken has broken.
Yes.
And what can you tell us? He's been accused of kissing, groping Leanne Tweeden.
Well, from what I can tell, it was a disgusting circumstance. And he, I'm sure in his mind, he thought this was a joke. This is the furthest thing from a joke. This is improper. It is harassment. It is forcing yourself on someone. I'm at a loss. I know Al so well, and I know what he cares about, and I know what a good senator he's been. The only thing I could say is I'm glad he said he welcomes an ethics investigation. He apologized for it. He didn't lie about it. And that's the good part. But this is a lot of bad. I mean, this is not funny. I have been myself, when I first came to the House, I had two colleagues in an open public hearing kind of make a joke about me.
Huh.
And I don't know if you want me to go into it.
I do.
It's a quick story, but it was quite young and compared to now. I was new, and it was my first bill, and I was on the Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee. And I was excited because I knew it was going to pass because I'd done due diligence, and it was about stopping the clubbing of baby seals. I don't know if you remember those.
Oh, I sure do.
When they were just little babies. So I had the bill, I made my pitch, and then the chairman says, anybody have a comment? And one of my colleagues, Democratic colleagues, said, I want to associate myself with the remarks of the congresswoman. I think he might have said with the gentle lady, which is totally appropriate. That language is exactly appropriate. But after he said it, he then added, come to think of it, I want to associate with the congresswoman from California.
Oh my.
And the whole audience laughed.
Ugh.
I turned bright red, and the chairman chimed in, so do I.
Ugh.
And it was so humiliating and demeaning. Now, it doesn't compare to another experience I had in college where there was a physical situation. So, but it is so disempowering, and when you're new, and I had to go to the chairman, and I said, Mr. Chairman, what happened was horrible. He said, we thought we were complimenting you. I said, that's not a compliment. I'm a legislator. I want to get things done. I want to win votes because of my legislation. And I said, will you take all this out of the record because it's so humiliating? And he did, and he apologized. But the problem we face is we have to come to grips with the fact that the culture it needs to change. And women have to be treated as equals. You treat a woman the way you'd want your daughter treated. You treat her the way you want to be treated. It's a whole revolution, and it has to happen.
And I think it is beginning to happen now. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. But, you know, I always put a caveat. Honestly, maybe it's a certain naivete I have, but after Anita Hill came forward, I honestly thought that was the signal. No man would want to be have all that dirty laundry out there. He would never get confirmed. He got confirmed. I later found out there were four other women who were waiting to testify with similar accounts, and they weren't allowed to by the men on the Judiciary Committee. And so that went awry. Then we had the Packwood case when I got into the United States Senate in the early 90s. And even though Mitch McConnell gets a lot of credit for saying he needs to leave, that what no one is reporting are the facts that it was me and the women of the Senate who had to push and push and threaten to make all this public. And, it's something I wrote about in my book, until he finally did it. But then I thought, okay, no other senator would dare ever touching a woman, harassing a woman, because it will all come out and they'll have to leave the Senate. And again, it didn't happen. So all I could say is this does feel like a moment of change. It truly does. But I always have this now, this worry that we could lose the moment. I just hope this moment will turn into what we all want, men and women of goodwill, that we want to be treated as equals. That's all we've ever wanted.
Senator, how pervasive do you think sexual harassment is currently in the Congress?
I can honestly say I'm not an expert on the subject, but from what I can hear listening to some of the Congresswomen, Jackie Speier and others, more on the House side than the Senate that I have heard, it's out there. And that they've had $15 million worth of settlements that sadly taxpayers have paid to keep it all quiet. There's really no fair system of justice there, which is about to change. And my opinion is, if after the hearings, a female or a male who is harassed is pronounced guilty of it, they should have to pay, not the taxpayers. It's just ridiculous, and not the campaigns either.
It does seem as though until there is parity in Congress, on the Senate and the House side, until there are an equal number of men and women on each side, that perhaps this will continue.
Well, I don't know if it will continue, because men and women of goodwill are saying, and we have to see what happens, that they're going to change the rules. Because right now there's an Office of Compliance. If you are harassed as a staffer and you go to complain to them, there's this big cooling off period. It's everyone knows you've done it. Then you have to come back again. It's just rigged against the person making the complaint. And then it's just taken care of quietly. And then these payments are made. I don't think we can wait until it's 50-50 in the House and Senate. At the rate we're going, that's going to put it out too long. I think this needs to become, you know, a campaign issue, and that people running for the Congress and the Senate this cycle, and you know every member of Congress is up, they have to say, I am for reforming this so that there's justice and that nobody who has committed this is going to be bailed out by the taxpayers or their own campaign. I think if the message goes, you are responsible financially, that could go a long way. We need more women, let's be clear,
yeah,
in the Senate and
of
the House.
Course.
I've fought for that forever. it does make a difference. But we can't wait for that. We have to make the changes now.
What do you know about the so-called creep list that's being circulated among Hill staffers?
I don't know anything about it. Remember, I'm not there now.
I know.
I'm still super involved in politics, and I am volunteering for my political action committee, and I'm involved, and I'm on TV talking about these things. But I don't know who's on the creep list, but that says it all right there. There are people that apparently the staff is warning about. Just like in Alabama all those years ago, he was on the creep list at the mall, and everyone said, if you see him coming, call us, because he lusts after teenage girls. So we've got this thing is shaking up our culture. Our culture needs to be shaken. Women are not there to be toys for men. And also, I could say a lot of this, although not in the great proportion of women, a lot of men are victims. People are not on this earth to be toyed with. They are to be respected. They are to be treated with dignity, regardless of their position, whether they have power or they don't have power. And all of this, at the bottom line, is about power. And bad people with power do bad things, and they need to be called on the carpet and not get away with it.
However, you have seen, as I have now, more and more accusers stepping forward in regard to Senate candidate Roy Moore. And yet, those people in Alabama who have supported him in the past say, number one, they don't believe the accusers. Number two, they will continue to vote for Roy Moore. What do you make of that?
Look, I can't climb into the heads of everybody in Alabama. I can only hope that all the voters there will read the Washington Post original story, will watch these women who have come forward since and gone on TV and told their stories. They're from Alabama. They're not from anywhere else. And if they were just with an open mind and an open heart, look at this. I don't see how they could vote for him. I mean, my thing that I say is, if you can't vote for the Democrat, write someone in. Write yourself in. It doesn't matter. Just because the man has an R behind his name, which I have said stands for repulsive in his case, you don't have to vote for this man. It seems like he has a hold over people. Break out of it. Do the right thing. You know, the man is, some people say, a pedophile, a child molester, and the biggest hypocrite on the face of the earth, because he runs around telling everyone they're immoral. He says he lives by the Ten Commandments. Well, what commandments are those? This man, if he gets to the United States Senate, they're going to expel him. They are.
You do believe that?
I believe they will. I believe they will. Yes. And how does that help the country? How does that help the Republican Party? How does that help the United States Senate? We have so many problems going on in our country, in the world. We want to solve. And then we're diverted with this sordid situation. I'm just saying, you know, whatever I say, whatever you say, whatever anyone says, it's up to the people of Alabama. One way or another, this guy is not going to be a senator. And so why don't you spare us all, look inside your heart and mind, read all the facts, listen to the women, and just vote for someone else. That's it, because it's going to be uglier for him. It's going to be worse for the victims, because they're going to have to bare their soul. It's a very painful thing.
Senator, do you believe that if you were still in office, you would have been able to speak out as strongly as you are speaking today?
I would speak out very strongly, but I think a few of my words would be different. If I was a senator, I don't think I wouldn't say the R stands for repulsive. I might have said R stands for regrettable. But for the most part, I've never been someone who has been silent. And if you go back to history, I took the lead on Packwood. I wrote about the fact that McConnell, Mitch, came over to me, and he and I wound up on very good terms at the end of my tenure. But at the beginning of my tenure, when I was fighting to get Packwood out of there, he threatened me and said, if you continue this, I'm going to expose Ted Kennedy, Tom Daschle's wife, because she's a lobbyist, and she shouldn't be a lobbyist, and all this. And I just looked at him and said, are you threatening me? And he said, I'm promising you. I mean, we really had it. And it's most of this stuff is documented. So I've always been, you know, very out front. I mean, it's very painful when you see people who you thought really carried out and lived their lives the way they vote in the Senate, you know, being accused of harassment. It's very tough. But the answer is definitely I'm unleashed and a little bit more, you know, straight from the heart.
I totally understand. You know, it's certainly not just the Senate and the House. We've seen Hollywood explode. Yeah. Harvey Weinstein. It's in every part of our society. And we've got to come to grips with it in some new way of understanding that women cannot be played as toys.
That's right.
That women are strong and women must stand up. I was shocked, Senator Boxer, to read about if a congressional aide wants to file a formal complaint, they first have to engage in 30 days of counseling. And then after 30 days, they can choose to go into mediation with a representative of the congressional office that they are lodging a complaint against, which can then at least last another 30 days, yeah. And then the accuser has to wait 30 more days. What kind of a system is this?
It's a mess, and it is going to bring down a lot of people if they don't stand up now and say they're ready to change it. You know, one of the most hypocritical things about all this is, of course, that Congress doesn't have to pay attention to any of the laws. So we have strong laws on the books against harassment in the private sector, okay? But in Congress, that we have our own rules. I remember as a United States Senator, I was told, whatever you care about in your office, put it in a handbook. And I had my handbook, my office manual that everyone had to read before they were joining my staff. And we said we have zero tolerance, and we laid it out very clearly. So our office did that. I don't know how many other offices did. I'm sure many did, but I bet some didn't. But it still can be a hostile workplace if the boss, regardless of the handbook, is, you know, stalking you. You can't really go to your superior there in the office. You go to this office of compliance, and you're told to cool off for 30 days. Why should you have to cool off for 30 days? You feel hurt. This is a mess, and it has to be changed. And I feel so badly that I didn't dig into this more when I was there. And again, I chalk it up to the fact that it's so unpleasant and horrible, and you don't want to think the worst of your colleagues. And in my case, I thought, when everyone saw that Packwood was run out on a rail, and then John Ensign, who had a very strange affair with his chief of staff's wife, and the chief of staff and the wife relied on him for their livelihood. And then the ethics committee did that, and we had a public airing of it in a very bipartisan way. And every time I thought, this is the signal. You know, this is the signal. It won't happen. It goes so deep, Diane. I don't know who to, I mean, for me, to. I guess we need to talk to psychologists and psychiatrists who understand what power does in the wrong hands, because this is about power. This is a sick thing to do to people who don't have as much power as you have. And so there needs to be training, and there also needs to be accountability. I'll say again, under the current rules of Congress, the person, even if they're wrong, they don't have to, let's say they are definitely abusers, and they settle this quietly, the taxpayers pay the money.
Exactly.
That is a disgrace, and it has to change. So just to sum up my view at this moment, to get back to your original question, is this a moment of change? In the Congress, there has to be change in terms of, A, letting people know that before they even take their all-powerful oath of office, they need to sit and listen to this stuff. And know it's all on the line. And know they will be held accountable and have to pay money out of their own pocket and be expelled if they engage in this. And have a process where perhaps it goes to an outside group of lawyers or judges. This thing's a mess. And apparently it's been going on, you know, under our noses when you have a group of staffers who are saying, what did you call it? The list of what?
The list of creeps.
The list of creeps. Well, guess what? It has to end. And I think if it ends in the halls of the legislature, that's a good thing. And then it has to go, you know, clearly Hollywood is looking at it. And it's pervasive, Diane.
Former Senator Barbara Boxer, it's great to talk with you. And I hear your strength and I hear your resolve. It comes right out of your book, The Art of Tough.
Yeah.
And I think we will all take your words to heed. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Diane, for your voice being out there. Yay, team, we're doing it.
We're doing it. Thanks
all
a
right.
lot. Bye-bye. And now, Jonathan Martin. He's national political correspondent for the New York Times and political analyst for CNN. Jonathan Martin, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
More allegations against Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore this week. A fifth woman has come forward with a story of sexual assault. Tell us about Beverly Nelson and what she said happened to her.
Well, this is a woman who said that that Mr. Moore basically forced himself on her after she had gotten off a shift at a restaurant in Gadsden, Alabama. And frankly, she alleges what sounds more like sexual assault than sexual harassment. So it sounds like this is a bit more of a serious claim.
You know, Jonathan, what's so extraordinary is that Mr. Moore was apparently banned from a local mall and the YMCA years ago.
Right. There's been some reporting that the Gadsden, Alabama mall had established a rule keeping him away because he was sort of known for basically trolling the mall and trying to flirt with younger sort of teenage women. Senator Lindsey Graham said as only he can that basically Mr. Moore was put on a no fly list for the mall, which is quite the sign.
You know, today the Washington Post has a front page story about two more women
right.
who say that Moore propositioned them at the mall while they were working at Sears. And one even said he called her high school to get her phone number. I mean,
right.
Jonathan, what in the world is going through this man's mind, even as he claims that all of these accusations are false. You've been following this story for quite a while.
I think that he hopes that he can just issue blanket denials and that people will stick with him because they overlook the details and return to their partisan tendencies. That's basically his gamble here, that it's a conservative state and that they're going to overlook these charges and stick with the Republican. I think a lot of folks in his party are skeptical of that happening, but that's certainly his assumption right now.
But even when you have a police officer speaking to the New Yorker magazine, telling them that this fellow named Roy Moore was cruising the mall looking for teenagers.
Right. Yeah, I think this has clearly hurt Moore. I just don't know that it's fatal, at least not yet, but there's still about a month to go here in the race. Look, here's the issue. I mean, I think there are voters who increasingly refuse to believe what they read as facts, and they're suspicious of motives. And then secondly, I think some voters make a calculation of this may not be a very fine person, but he's going to vote in a way that I prefer over the other guy. And that's sort of where we're at in this country now politically.
Sort of interesting, however, that a number of Republican leaders have called on him to step aside, including Leader McConnell and Speaker Ryan.
Right.
Is this getting through?
There's a gulf between the kind of Washington Republican reaction and the reaction in Alabama. The House delegation from Alabama, which is almost entirely Republican, has so far stood with Moore, that they have not disavowed him. Been a very different reaction from the congressional leadership and from the nation's governors who have urged him to step aside. They're worried about the impact that this could have on their own party in the midterm elections, and they don't want Mr. Moore undermining them next year because they fear that Democrats could sort of use him, if he does win, as something of a cudgel and could sort of taint the party's candidates by reminding voters of the fact that somebody who's accused to be a sexual predator is sitting in the Senate.
How does Sean Hannity enter into all this?
Well, he's a conservative talk show host who's got a wide following on the political right, and Mr. Moore sought what he thought would be a fairly safe harbor to offer his side of the story by going on Mr. Hannity's radio show. I think he created some more problems for himself by doing that interview, saying, for example, that he never dated a woman without getting the permission of her mother, which, you know, if you're having to ask for the permission of the mother to date the girl, she might be too young in the first place. That's what a lot of Republicans said afterwards. And so Hannity, you know, gave him the first interview, but now there's pressure on Hannity to disavow Moore because of the nature of these charges, too. And it kind of recalls the 2012 campaign where there was a fellow in Missouri named Todd Akin who was running for the Senate against Claire McCaskill and was on live TV and made a comment that women could not become impregnated when they were raped, and it created a huge firestorm. And you know, similarly, Mr. Akin went on the Hannity show and tried to tell his side of the story, and eventually the kind of party condemned him. But he, you know, refused to drop out of the race and lost that election. And you are seeing a kind of similar trajectory here play out. We don't know what the results are going to be here, but there's no question that Moore has been wounded by this story politically.
Do you think there might be a write-in campaign?
Yeah, I mean, the initial response from the Republican establishment was, how can we fix this problem? What can we do? And one of the first thoughts was, let's do a write-in campaign, and who was popular. And the first thought was the current senator who was appointed to fill this seat, Senator Luther Strange. But he lost pretty convincingly to Moore a couple months ago in the Republican primary. So they kind of dispensed with that. And then there was some talk about Jeff Sessions, the former occupant of the seat and the current attorney general, stepping in and leaving his post to run as a write-in candidate. And Mitch McConnell was certainly into that idea, but that doesn't seem to be taking off either. And there's some talk about the governor shifting the date of the election, but I can tell you, I'm in Austin, Texas right now with the Republican Governors Association. I talked to the governor of Alabama briefly yesterday, and when I asked her if she was still supporting Mr. Moore, she gave me an answer of the following: the election will be on December the 12th. So she has, I think, clearly no appetite to change the date of the election.
What if Roy Moore is elected to the Senate? He survives the election.
Right.
And, of course, you've referred to what Senator Lindsey Graham said on Wednesday. He said, I've got a general rule. If you can't be in the mall, you shouldn't be in the Senate. So,
right, that was a pretty good line.
So does that mean they're going to throw him out?
Yes. I think if he does win the election, I think there would be a move to expel him from the Senate. And I think that that right now that would probably win 2/3 of a vote. Here's the challenge, though, is that for Republicans, that's a pretty messy proposition, and it would only further exacerbate the sort of tensions between the establishment wing of the party in Washington and the grassroots. So this is why you see so many Republican leaders grasping for any fix here, trying to figure out what can be done. And, you know, talking about write-ins, which is sort of far-fetched, they're just trying to figure out a way to avert having to deal with the mess of expulsion hearings. In some ways, you talk to Republicans privately, and they will tell you that the cleanest solution here may be for the Democrat to win the election outright, because then you don't have to confront this challenge of what to do with Moore.
Jonathan, I have one last question for you. We've seen so many reports over the last few weeks and months about sexual harassment. How does all this make you feel as a man?
Sad, uneasy.
Uneasy. How does it make you feel uneasy?
That there are men out there who conduct themselves in this way with women, and I don't think that what I would call normal, well-adjusted men who don't behave like this. I don't think that we fully appreciated just how many men do act like this, and how pervasive it was with a lot of our wives and sisters and friends and daughters. So. Yeah, it's troubling. There's no question about it. Because I think that most men who don't act like this, but don't experience this because they're men, that didn't fully appreciate how pervasive this is. And it's disconcerting.
Jonathan Martin, he's national political correspondent for the New York Times, a political analyst for CNN. Thank you, Jonathan. It's good to talk with you again.
Thanks, Diane. I enjoyed it.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Sheila Nevins is president of HBO Documentary Films and author of a new book titled You Don't Look Your Age and Other Fairy Tales. Sheila Nevins, how great to talk with you.
Thank you.
In your book, You Don't Look Your Age and Other Fairy Tales, you talk a lot about your own experiences through poetry, through essays, through fables, through, indeed, I think, true stories. Your book came out before these scandals broke. But you do talk a lot about what it was like to be a woman in the film business and how you even had to use sex to get ahead. Talk about that.
You know, I've gotten a lot of criticism for it, but I don't really care because sex was the rules of the game when I began in the 60s. I said to someone last night, and it was really a very highbrow crowd at the National Quote Book Review, you know. I said that on Friday of 1 week in 1960, let's say I got out of Yale in 1962. So in 1964, I was typing letters on a Friday, and I had my first production assistant job on a Monday. And what I did between that Friday and Monday was screw my boss.
Wow.
And as vulgar and disgusting as that sounds, it worked, Diane. I'm sorry to tell you that. I don't want to say it did, but it did. I'd probably still be typing on a computer today. I got a job in the Job Corps as a production assistant. I mean, my God, I was married to a man who wouldn't let me leave the house. I had to be home in the evenings, and I had to be there on weekends. I'd gotten my master's in theater and directing at Yale. I was ready to direct. I was ready to go, and I got a typing job. So what do you want me to do, Diane? I was pretty, and I was young, and those were the rules. I'm sorry they were the rules, and I'm glad they're not the rules anymore, but they were the rules. And so, you know, that's it.
So your thoughts on the accusations of sexual harassment and assault coming out of Hollywood. You worked with Harvey Weinstein in the past. Tell me about your experiences.
Okay, well, I'm old now. Okay, Diane, I'm an old lady. I shouldn't say that. Someone said, don't say old, say older lady. I'm an older lady.
You know you're not as old as I am.
We're very close, Diane. I read your book, and I loved every page of it.
Thank you.
Diane Rehm, a great book about being old, about death, and the need to die with a crown on your head.
And I just got married again.
I know. I read it. I looked you up. I mean, you know. So now you're on my own times two.
Exactly.
But you were on my own times one.
Exactly.
But the thing is, by the time I worked with Harvey, and it was not actually on a film, but on the acceptance and then rejection of a documentary, when I accepted the docu, he was lovely to me. I'm too old to be touched anymore. I'm like from the neck up. You know what I mean? There's an advantage to keeping working, being lucky in terms of your health, and keeping working in your 70s because, in fact, nobody touches you anymore. Nobody tells you how unhappy they are with their wife. Nobody tells you how beautiful you are. Nobody tells you how beautiful your tits are. They leave you alone. So there's an equality in aging, which is only counterbalanced by the fact that you're old. But if you're smart enough and you've been there long enough, there's a certain equality that you earn as you get your wrinkles. I've earned that equality.
But when you were younger, did you realize you did not want this to happen to you anymore?
I know the PC answer. The answer is yes, I didn't want it to happen to me anymore. The truth is that I didn't think I had a choice. I didn't know until I hit my 50s that everything that I had accepted as the rules of the game were irregular, dishonest, and vulgar, and not necessary. But I didn't know. I didn't know. I thought it was on the application form. Will you be harassed? Yes. Will you listen to men about how unhappily married they are? Yes. Will you listen to men about how sexy you are next to their wives? Yes. Will you keep quiet about what's happening in the office between some young new intern and the boss? Yes. Those were the things that I checked off in my head. And so those were the rules by which I played the game. I don't want to be dishonest. On the other hand, I don't want to be vulgar and not of the moment. Of the moment, I think I'd punch a guy if he touched me. But they're not touching me anymore, Diane.
So you are now a boss in a position of power. And so what are you doing to create a workplace that does not tolerate harassment?
I don't think it happens. I think we have zero tolerance at HBO. I think we always have. There have always been more women in the top than before. I think if I knew of it, I would stop it. And I'm not a revolutionary. I'm not Joan of Arc. I'm not Gloria Steinem. Was Joan of Arc a revolutionary?
You
bet. I don't really know. She may have been just nuts.
You bet. But
anyway, I don't really see it anymore. I haven't seen it for the last 15 or so years. I had heard it prior to that, and I did nothing. I just turned my head the other way. I think, not that I'm braver, but the environment is such that I would be supported. There are human resources. There are places to go. I can tell a woman, so interesting. I was at Refinery 29 talking to the women there about sex and all that, and I thought these little girls in their torn jeans and their wrinkled blouses, no one's approaching them. And some beautiful blonde woman came over to me afterwards. She probably was 25 years old. And she said, there's this guy that's hitting on me. You know, I work here part-time and then I work at da-da-da-da-da. And this guy's sort of hitting on me. What should I do? What should I say?
Yeah.
I said, well, why don't you tell him? And I don't know where it came from, but, you know, I said, why don't you tell him you thought more of him, that you're disappointed in him, that you thought that he was a person of value and that you respected so his mind and that you thought he respected yours. And then you said, no, thank you. But I wouldn't have known to say those things,
yeah.
20. I wouldn't have known.
Understand.
It's as if I learned another language. So I can't be blamed for the language that I spoke originally. Although, people say, you shouldn't have done that. But the point really is I didn't have a choice. I mean, I wouldn't be Sheila today if I wasn't Sheila of yesterday.
Interesting. So now aging is a big theme of your book. And one of the first stories is about facelifts.
Yeah.
What did looking older represent to you?
Disposal. Like used food. Or like you open the refrigerator and you say something smells bad and you look and you say, oh, it's the tuna fish I had 2 days ago. I didn't want to be that tuna fish. I've done horrible things. I have had 2 facelifts. I have, as soon as I see a wrinkle, I go running in. I am the product, the disappointing product. I wish I could say, come on, wrinkles, let's go. Come on, hair, let's go, gray, let's go. Let's go, girls. But I don't say it. I have fallen for the culture. I can't help it. I don't know what to do.
So I saw you here in Washington a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And I thought you looked beautiful.
It was dark. I love dark. You know, people say, what restaurant do you want to meet in? I don't know the names of the restaurant. I know the lighting. I say, well, let's meet at the Carlisle. Let's meet at, so-and-so. It's dark there. I look good in the dark. I was always pretty. I'm still pretty, but I'm old. Come on, I'm old. One day I'll be like the one who is Shay. I'll wake up, when they do my autopsy, they'll say, there's a strange thing in her called like Botox or Elmer's glue that's pasting her together.
Okay, but on the other hand,
yes,
is
Diane.
There anything of value to you about being older?
Yes.
What?
I mean, men think of me as equal. Young men look up to me. Women admire my honesty. I hope you're one of them. I think that I'm not, maybe I'm as sharp as I was. As a matter of fact, I'm more efficient than I used to be. For instance, if I'd had a meet when I was 30, if I had to be on this show at 9:30 or whatever time, I would leave the house at 7. Because I'd be so afraid I'm late.
Yeah, me
now,
too. Me too.
You see,
Same thing.
Yeah, well, you see, now time is so important that I have my last cup of coffee before I leave, and I give myself just enough time to get here. And if I'm late, I figure if she loves me enough, she'll do it another time. But I didn't have the angst I would have had a long time ago about, I have to be there early. What if I'm late? What if they don't want me? What if they take somebody else? What if they don't? I don't have that. It's gone.
Good.
It's gone.
Now, many of these stories are about you or characters who represent you, but there are a few others, like the giant named Tourette's.
Yes.
Tell us about that story.
Okay, well, my son has Tourette's. He said something so, I'm going to cry. Okay, he said something very interesting to me a few days ago. Please, David, don't listen to this. Okay, listen to it. He said, I said, why are you so tired, David? You didn't have such a hard day. He said, Mom, I spent a large part of my day holding back my Tourette's.
Ah.
And suddenly, you know, he has a very mild case. He had a rather serious case when he was young, but in puberty, one of two things happened. In most cases, Tourette's, which is a tic, neurological tic disorder, and a sound disorder. But anyway, he, as a child, blinked his eyes. He did all kinds of things. He grunted. He lifted his shoulder up. He touched things. He did all kinds of things that were Tourette-ic. And then suddenly, through puberty and experimental medicine and stuff like that, he began to have very, very minor tics. And now at 37, he has practically no visible tics.
Huh.
But I hadn't realized.
Huh.
I hadn't realized that part of it is control. I thought it was all gone. And when he said that, I realized once a Tourette, always a Tourette-ic kid or adult, but that you're lucky when the symptoms get mild. But we raised, David and I, we read from my book, You Don't Look Your Age in Other Fairy Tales. We read the one about the giant named Tourette's. And we, with other people at the Tourette's Association, raised $3.2 million in research.
Wonderful.
And it was so exciting.
How
and we
wonderful.
Got up there and we read the story. He read half and I read half.
Wow.
And he didn't tick once. It was perfect.
Yay.
I kept making mistakes.
Yay.
I you know.
Yay for you.
Yay, right? Yay.
Now, tell me about your mom.
Oh, well, my mom had Raynaud's disease, which also comes very often with scleroderma, which is a hardening of the skin in your extremities and the lack of circulation. And my mom died at 57, I think, without three fingers on her right hand, no arm on her, I mean, half an arm on her left hand and no leg and two toes missing. And so my mother was an amputee of the major kind. She had the worst kind of Raynaud's and scleroderma ever. But I guess you're referring to the story where we were in a restaurant. This was halfway through her amputory, if there's such a word, career. And she had no arm. And the amputation was above the elbow. So the arm was too short to go under the counter, you know, where they have a little ridge.
Yes.
So the amp, it was sort of like swinging.
Yes.
And I covered it with her shirt. I rolled her shirt. It was a very hot day. Covered it with her shirt, knotted it. And she was very hot. So I said, oh, who gives a, you know, I don't know if you can say the word. Who gives a bleh? And so I untied the knot and I pushed up her stump and her stump showed. And we loved the coffee. We loved the cream cheese in that restaurant, in the coffee shop. And then some woman yelled across, please, ladies, put that arm away. It's making me nauseous. So I didn't know what to do. I mean, I didn't know what to do. So I rolled down the sleeve. I retied the knot so she wouldn't see it. And then everybody in the restaurant started arguing with this lady. It was right near Barnard where I'd gone. It was a chock full of nuts place. And they all started yelling, you know, they're eating. We're eating. We shouldn't see it. What do you mean? She's disabled. You should let it happen. Oh, come on. Stop it. You know. So my mother and I got up. We left our lunch. We went outside.
Wow.
And I apologized to this woman, this crazy lady. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And when I tied the knot back, I was sorry for an illness. I was sorry for amputation. I was a jerk. And I should have said to her, this is it, baby. This is life. They come back from war this way, and they come back from disease this way, and none of us are perfect, and some of us are damaged inside, and some of us are damaged outside, and you're damaged inside. But I didn't say that. I said,
Sheila,
I'm sorry.
You are who you are. You are articulate. You are outspoken. You say what you think. But I wonder whether putting it all in writing, as you have done in this book, has somehow lifted some kind of burden from you.
Diane, you're very smart. Will you be my friend? Will you be my neighbor?
I promise.
Like one of those
I
old,
promise.
You promise. Okay,
I'd love
so
to.
I would say that this is it. It's almost a friend, a very, very good friend, and I don't have that many left, said to me very sweetly, it's like a 200 and something page memorial service, isn't it? You're in the stories, you're out of the stories, you're always truthful, you know, it's you. I don't feel like I have that much more to say. I think the only thing left, I mean, other than wanting to work until I become, you know, just disappear, I think I want to talk about harassment above the neck. We've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, touching and feeling and screwing and being manipulated and all that stuff. I think there is also for women in the workplace a kind of emotional harassment that is demeaning, demoralizing, and destructive. And that is something that I think we're sort of concentrating on the physical because it's the most salacious. But I think there is an interruption. There is a putting down. There is a not listening. There is, oh, let's get a woman to the meeting. Oh, call Sheila. Call Sheila. She's high up. Let's get a woman to the meeting. You know, you know, and then, you know, what are they saying in the back of their minds? It looks right. We'll have a Black, a Chicano, we'll have a white woman, and then there'll be 36 men. So I think the whole idea of above-the-neck harassment is something that intrigues me because I think I have been and will always be the victim of that. And it's a very subtle kind of demoralization, which I think is very difficult to define. But it's a kind of invisibility. I mean, you're there, your body's there, your mind's there, your thoughts are there, but you're not really present. I think that above-the-neck stuff is very hard to describe. I'd love to be able to describe it to women. Because as men are now afraid to touch you or to do anything aggressive, but I think the next step is, how are you treating me emotionally in the workplace, intellectually? Are you interrupting me?
I think you have just outlined your next book.
I can't do it. You have to do it with me. I can't do it alone anymore. It was such agony. First of all, you're like a prostitute. You got to sell your book like you're selling, you know, your wares. I'm selling my wares. I don't want to sell my wares. I don't mind writing a book and putting it on a shelf. It's the selling part that's so impossible. I mean, you go to a bookstore, there's 35 women and two of them buy your book. I mean, you know, so like you can't make any money. Not that you have to make money on a book, but you have to feel a certain kind of energy. Or maybe it's just that I grew up in television, so numbers are so important to me. I check my book numbers. You know, yeah. If someone comes over to me and says they like my book, even if they're the me, I love them. I love them, even though I don't even know them. I mean, I'm pathetic. I don't want to go through this again. It's too hard. You write the book, and I'll write the intro. How's that?
That would be fabulous. And let me
I can't tell promise you a dollar, though. I can just tell you can write it.
Let me just tell you how much I love your book. I've read every single page, and I know the truth that you have written, and it's just fabulous.
And I love John Rem. I read your book. And I read it in one night. It's called On My Own, and it's really about watching someone die ugly when they can die beautifully. And I just went through that with Liz Smith, really. And she wanted out, and she had to do it her way, which was, you know, like John's way, which was, I don't mean to call him John, Mr. M's way, which was basically, you know, just starving herself. But she couldn't, she had no, there was no one to help her go. And you know, I think we share that desire to make people go, you know, go dreaming, not with nightmares.
Exactly. Sheila Nevins, I can't thank you enough for being so honest, being so forthright, and telling it like it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
That's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced this week by Allison Brody and Lisa Dunn. Our engineers are Timothy Olmsted and Jake Cherry. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.